at his table.
Beginning Saturday, May 2nd, Lucky Strike's famous musical program, Your Hit Parade, America's 15 leading songs of the week, will be heard over 93 Columbia stations every Saturday night at 10 o'clock, Eastern Daylight Saving Time.
Ladies and gentlemen, in the grand ballroom of the Hotel Commodore in New York City, the National Democratic Club of New York observes Thomas Jefferson's birthday with a dinner at which the guest of honor is the President of the United States. Surrounded by 2,500 guests in evening clothes, by high-ranking members of the Democratic Party, the President sits at his table with Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt and Mrs. James Roosevelt, the President's mother. Later, he will address the dinner guests and you of Columbia's radio audience. First, we ought to hear the Honorable Herbert H. Lehman, the Governor of the State of New York, who will be introduced by the Honorable Cornelius F. Collins, Justice of the Court of General Sessions. To open this evening's Jefferson Dinner Program, allow me to present first Mr. Thomas J. McMahon, who is the President of the National Democratic Club of New York. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. McMahon.
Mr. President, Governor Lehman, distinguished guests, fellow members of the National Democratic Club, ladies and gentlemen, once again, it brings me great happiness as President of the National Democratic Club to welcome this splendid gathering upon the occasion of our annual dinner in celebration of the memory of the immortal Jefferson. This is an historic occasion, for it brings to us our highly distinguished and beloved member, the President of the United States. In the midst of his tremendous problems and continuous work, has been so gracious as to come here tonight to speak to us and to the millions who will listen to his voice over a network of more than 200 stations. Mr. President, this club and this great gathering are sincerely thankful to you. We are also deeply grateful to our dear friend, Governor Lehman, for coming. For coming, as he always has done in the past, to bring us a timely message. Before turning over the gavel to our toastmaster, I wish to record my appreciation for the efforts of all the loyal gentlemen of the club, the dinner and the reception committee. Judge Cornelius F. Collins, our chairman, Mr. John Cunahan, our dinner committee secretary, and the broadcasting companies for their very willing cooperation and hard, untiring labors in the making this dinner the success it so surely is. We have been fortunate indeed in having our chairman as our chairman, Mr. Judge Cornelius F. Collins, the Court of General Sessions of the State of New York. He needs no introduction to this audience. I will now turn over the conduct of our meeting to Judge Collins.
Excellency, President Roosevelt. Mrs. Roosevelt, our First Lady. Mrs. James Roosevelt, esteemed mother of our President. Your Excellency, Governor Lehman. Mrs. Lehman. Reverend and many distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, of this magnificent and impressive assemblage and of the vast multitude on the air, the National Democratic Club extends to you its warm greetings and felicitations on this happy event in celebration of the 193rd anniversary of the birthday of Thomas Jefferson. This splendid banquet attendance of sterling men and women not only of this city, but from near and far, with the accompanying atmosphere and surroundings, the presence and active participation of the President of the United States and of the Governor of the State of New York, the gracious attendance of members of their respective families, the presence in such large numbers of outstanding public men and women, governors, cabinet officers, United States senators, distinguished leaders of our party, is a gratifying unction and crowning glory to us at this, the 102nd annual Jefferson dinner of our club. We feel justified in feeling that tonight history may be in the making. Formal address of a Toastmaster would be unbecoming. Only a brief reminder of the trend of the inspirational theme of the day we celebrate is permissible. Jefferson's tomb bears an inscription of his own composition. Here lies buried Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of Independence, of the Statute of Virginia for Religious Freedom, and father of the University of Virginia. To this sentiment, posterity has added in characters of ever-living light, founder of the Democratic Party. And lest we forget, we may be pardoned on an occasion like this for repeating from the Declaration, in affectionate remembrance, his universally familiar, soul-stirring, immortal words. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the government. Reference may likewise be made to the first of his enumerated essential principles of our government, proclaimed at his first inauguration. Equal and exact justice to all men of whatever state or persuasion, religious or political. We are a cosmopolitan people. To ensure our living together in harmony, peace, and prosperity requires real governmental genius. Social equality, as expressed in terms of democracy, is the Jeffersonian solution in the attainment of this high degree of political happiness. The late president of the University of Virginia, Professor Alderman, defined Jeffersonian democracy, where every man has the right to make the most of himself and knows that he has a chance. Our guests of honor tonight are stalwart exponents of this democratic doctrine, and by agreement have arranged their order of addressing you. And now, in keeping with the purpose for which we are assembled, the National Democratic Club is profoundly happy to have the opportunity to present its distinguished member and former vice president, the energetic and indefatigable governor of the state of New York, financier, soldier, and statesman, His Excellency Herbert H. Lehman.
President Roosevelt and Mrs. Roosevelt, Postmaster General Farley, Senator Wagner, President McMahon, Judge Collins, my fellow members of the Democratic Club, and I deem it a particular privilege to salute the youngest member of the Roosevelt family, Mrs. James Roosevelt. Mr. President, I am very happy indeed, both as governor and just as a friend, to welcome you to your own state, which you have served with such great distinction for many years. And I also deem it a privilege to have the opportunity of welcoming to our state the beloved governor of our neighboring Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, Governor Earle. Few men have wielded so great an influence on their country as the man in whose honor we are gathered here tonight, Thomas Jefferson. His philosophy of government was simple, yet eternally true. It is no less potent today than when he gave it warmth and strength through his own leadership. He based his whole passionate belief in democracy on the formula of faith. Faith in the honesty of the great mass of people. Faith in their common sense. Faith that ignorance and prejudice can be overcome by education. And faith that a just cause must finally prevail. These ideals have become the very foundation of American representative democracy. Jefferson abhorred class institutions. He hated class government. His trust and confidence in the sound judgment of the people was strong. His belief in the principle that governments derive their strength only from the will of the government was abiding. In a letter addressed to the legislature of the state of New York, he said, "Representative government is that which produces the greatest sum of happiness to mankind." In his first inaugural address, he proclaimed, "I stand for equal and exact justice to all men of whatever state or persuasion, religious or political." He never wavered in his conviction that our democratic form of government is a vehicle created by the people for their own protection and in their exclusive interest, and for the purpose of securing for all citizens equal opportunity and equal security so far as human intelligence can bring that about. above everything else. My friends, we as Democrats must never for a moment weaken in our adherence to the great Jeffersonian principle of service and equality. We can maintain the strength of our party only through service to all people, without favor and without discrimination. Government must give a fair chance to all and special privilege to none. It must protect all rights, safeguard man in his strength, and protect the weak from possible encroachment of the strong. That principle is the bulwark upon which the Democratic Party was built and upon it which it now stands. That is the reason for its success and for the confidence the people have in it. The Democratic Party has never been willing to consider class or special interest. It has never been a respecter of mere position, of power, or of wealth. It has always recognized two primary duties. First, to provide efficient and effective administration. And second, to interpret and crystallize ideals and social requirements into sound, humane, and enlightened action. The purpose of government is not only to protect the lives and the property of its people, important and essential as that is, but also to bring increased happiness, increased contentment and security into the homes of its people. And no government that fails to fulfill these functions can claim to be either progressive or enlightened. Government must have a heart and a conscience and be concerned with the human problems which touch the daily lives of its people just as much as it is concerned with material progress. It is true that you cannot have a happy and contented people unless you have a prosperous people. But it is equally the fact that you cannot have either a happy people or a permanently prosperous people unless social progress proceeds at least as rapidly as material progress, and unless substantially equal opportunity is afforded to all. We can be proud that the Democratic Party has sought and seeks today to place the common welfare above the interest of individual or of groups. The philosophy of the Democratic Party, that sound government must concern itself with human life above property rights, has never been demonstrated more convincingly than during the past 3 years. Because of the determination that human rights must be safeguarded, there has recently been enacted, both in the nation and in the state of New York, a program of social legislation which, in my opinion, has never been surpassed in importance or in beneficial interest. At the very forefront of that program, there stands, of course, the Federal Social Security Act, undoubtedly the most comprehensive and effective piece of social legislation ever enacted in the country of this or of any other nation. Through the Federal Emergency Relief Administration and its collateral agencies, the nation's needy unemployed have been sheltered, fed, and in many cases given productive work. New York, like other states, has had to look to the federal government for a great part of the funds needed to care for its needy unemployed. Without federal cooperation, the problem could not have been handled, nor could it be handled today if such assistance were reduced. Legislation has been enacted at Washington for the protection of the home and the farm owner, for slum clearance and low-priced housing. The farmer has been much aided in overcoming his serious difficulties. the basic rights of the wage earner have been recognized and proclaimed and protected in statute. It is, of course, not possible in the limited time at my disposal to describe even a small part of the great program enacted by the federal government since March of 1933. In our own New York State, we have enacted a minimum wage law for women, one of the first laws of its kind in this country. It has been closely followed by seven other states. We have in this state provided for unemployment insurance, the constitutionality of which I am glad to say was affirmed by the Court of Appeals only a few days ago. We adopted a broad program of labor legislation, both in 1934 and in 1935. And we are fighting today for the enactment of the State Social Security Act. That act, if adopted, as I hope it will be by the legislature, will help our old people, our blind, our crippled children, our dependent children, and will provide maternity and child welfare services, vocational rehabilitation, and broader public health services for the state people of our state. The Democratic Party has never hesitated, either in nation or in state, to provide such services for our people, and particularly for those who are less privileged. But hand in hand with efforts towards social betterment has proceeded an endless, militant fight for the economic and financial rehabilitation of our country. The memory of men is notoriously short. Frequently we forget even the most dramatic situations we have confronted and through which we have lived. And yet I imagine that few who are actors in the drama will ever forget the situation with which we had to cope in those soul-stirring and terrifying days of 3 years ago. They certainly will always remain fresh in my memory. Days of worry, days of grave concern and endless activity, followed by nights no less harried and no less active. With regard to those months, I speak not as a detached observer. The governor of New York had to live and work in the very center of that unforgettable drama. You, my friends, will recall that during the early months of 1933, there came into our national life an ever-growing spirit of fear and of distrust. Whatever the causes, the results of the Depression were disastrous. Industries vied with each other in reducing personnel, in cutting salaries and wages, in eliminating construction activities, and in postponing, wherever possible, even necessary maintenance operations. The wheel of prosperity on which we had been riding for many years first slowed up, then stopped, and finally went into reverse. We found an army of unemployed daily becoming larger, and the ability of people to buy even for their current needs ever less. This trend increased in momentum and grew in size, and in its wild course threatened to crush industry and workers alike. Prices of commodities and of manufactured goods had crumbled. Banks all over the country were closing their doors. Bank holidays had been declared in a number of states. Security values had crashed to only a fraction of their former level. I will not forget that people were helpless and were rapidly becoming hopeless. They were on the verge of hysteria and panic. Each day brought greater unrest and deeper fear. Men distrusted each other, but above all, They distrusted their government. During those days, I met and worked with an endless stream of merchants, manufacturers, professional men, and labor leaders. There was little difference in the state of mind of banker, merchant, or manufacturer. The psychology of fear and discouragement was substantially the same in every group of our business leaders. The spirit of the day was every man for himself. The man who had something to sell wanted to get rid of it, regardless of intrinsic value before the smash came. The man who had money in the bank wanted to take it out before the expected disaster. The situation was tersely but well indicated in a statement of the Committee of the Clearinghouse Banks in New York City, requesting on the night of March 3rd that the governor proclaim a bank holiday. Their words were in part, the request of the Clearinghouse Committee to the governor is based on the continued and increasing withdrawals of currency and of gold from the banks of the country. The unthinking attempt of the people to convert over $40 billion of deposits into currency at one time is on its face impossible. Panic and hopelessness had gripped the country by March 4th, 1933, the day on which Franklin D. Roosevelt took office as President of the United States. And you, my friends, I am certain will remember what happened after March 4th. By night of that very first day, the president and his cabinet were already busily at work. It seemed almost as if a miracle had come to our people. Hope was reborn in the hearts of men and women. They again took courage because they realized that there was courage, vigor, and strength in high places. In the days that followed, men squared their shoulders again, willing to fight the good fight. From discouraged, disorganized, frightened crowds of men and women emerged a self-reliant, courageous, and optimistic nation. Banks reopened, assured that through legislative and administrative action of the federal and state governments, ample liquidity of their institutions could be maintained. To them returned the great army of depositors, confidently reassured by the federal and state government's virtual guarantee of the solvency of the vast majority of our financial institutions. Insurance companies, on which large demands for loan and surrender values had been made, rapidly resumed free and unrestricted relations with their policyholders and with the public. Today, they are stronger than ever. Gradually, during 1933, merchants and manufacturers again took off, and increasing numbers during the succeeding months transformed losses into profits. By the autumn of that year, through wise legislation and effective administration, and particularly because of the courage that was imparted by courageous leaders, our people had taken new heart. I shall never forget the memorable NRA parade in which many thousands of people, men and women, marched up Fifth Avenue in unbroken lines for a period of nearly 12 hours. And my friends, whatever may have been the weaknesses of the NRA, do not let us ever forget that it was the expression of a new hope, a new confidence, a new enthusiasm for the nation. people were coming out of their lethargy. They were shaking off discouragement and were once more facing the future with a feeling of security. Oh, it is easy to criticize. It is easy after the fact to know where mistakes could have been avoided. Regardless of any other considerations, however, there is no question in my mind but that the NRA served a great purpose at a time when courage, hope, enthusiasm, and action were most needed. 3 years have passed, and now a completely different picture meets the eye. Banks, insurance companies, and other financial institutions are stronger than ever. Their deposits have increased. They have gained in assets and in earnings. And what is most important, they again have the full confidence of the public. Merchants and manufacturers were hopeless and impotent because of falling sales and depreciated inventories have changed operating deficits into substantial profits. And even a few figures will tell the story. Cotton, which on March 1st, 1933, was selling below 6 cents, is now at 11.5 cents. Wheat, which was at 48 cents a bushel, is now at $1. Instead of 24 cents a bushel, corn is at 62 cents. ...134%, and there have been no failures on the stock exchange. Of 32 very important industrial corporations... In January 1933... the production of steel was 861,000 gross tons. And last month, it was 3,300,000. Listed securities from January 1933 to January 1936 advanced 134%. And there have been no failures on the stock exchange. Of 32 very important industrial corporations, 22 reported deficits in 1932, and only two in 1935. The total profits of that 10, of the 10 that showed returns in 1932, were barely $38 million for that year. While in 1935, for the same corporations, the profits were $887 million. One great automobile company in 1932 made a profit of $165,000. In 1935, it increased this profit just 1,000-fold to $167 million. Another had a profit of $34 million in 1935, against a deficit of $11 million in 1932. Business for the first 6 months of 1936 gives every indication that substantial gains in profit and volume will be shown over a similar period of last year. It is reported that business activity in the second quarter of this year will attain the highest level since the midsummer of 1930. Exceeding the corresponding period of a year ago by from 10 to 15%. Steel production, according to the Iron and Steel Institute, for the first quarter of this year was at the best level for any quarter since 1930. March sales of the General Motors Company were the largest for any March in the company's history, and also the largest for any month of the year since 1931. since 1928. I could continue these encouraging and hopeful statistics almost indefinitely. Company after company, in widely diversified lines of business activity, is showing not only very much larger profits over the past 3 years, but in many cases is even duplicating the very best years prior to the Depression. These figures, my friends, need no enlargement to remove any doubt as to the degree of recovery that has come to us since President Roosevelt took the helm of the nation on March 4, 1933. Perhaps it may be considered academic to debate whether or not Thomas Jefferson, were he living today, would or would not have approved a particular policy or a particular action of the Democratic administration at Washington. More significant, however, is the assurance that the philosophy of the Democratic Party today embraces those principles so forcefully exemplified by Thomas Jefferson. No matter what standards are applied to the past 3 years, nobody can deny that we have made much progress. In a word, we have laid the foundation stones upon which the great numbers of our people, the wage earner, the small salaried man, the small tradesman, the small businessman, and the average professional man can hereafter build a better home for a better and happier life. That basic program must continue. It is in the interest of America. Those who believe in it, be they Democrat, Republican, nonpartisan, or independent, should pool their energies in support of our beloved President, Franklin D. Roosevelt.
Hotel Commodore, draped with American flags and banners of the several states, the crowded audience rises and formally dressed men and women stand grouped about their flower bank dinner tables, applauding as the governor of New York State concludes his address and returns to his seat at the speaker's table. The Honorable Cornelius F. Collins, the General Sessions Justice of New York, is about to introduce the President of the United States as soon as our networks are synchronized. In a moment, you will hear the voice once again of Judge Collins, who is standing at the speaker's stand, waiting to address the visible audience and you of Columbia's radio audience. Judge Collins.
And now, with the eloquent voice of the governor still ringing in our ears, and the force of its thrill still reverberating within us, comes the happy moment of a great expectation. To hear the voice of the president of our country. It is pleasant to contemplate that he is our president of today, a Democrat, speaking at a birthday celebration of our president of an earlier day, the illustrious founder of his party, to whose precepts, enduring as time, he is running true to form. as a champion of social justice, equality, and popular rights. President Roosevelt, at the very outset of his administration, was beset with graver dangers of an internal nature, of serious menace to the Republic, than confronted any other president since Abraham Lincoln. On the very day of his inauguration, while the nation was rejoicing in the ceremony attendant upon his elevation, an enforced bank holiday was precipitated. Stagnated industry, widespread unemployment, and destitution were his legacy. Dire peril and distress, panic and disaster threatened our material and social welfare. His country, our beloved land, was in the throes of an economic depression involving all the perplexities of a critical emergency. With a spirit and alacrity, wisdom and Herculean courage, born of a force of character amounting to genius, he tackled the sinister problems thrust upon him. As our chief executive, he took the helm of the ship of state undismayed and guided us into a haven of safety and security with the port of prosperity and happiness now in sight. If rocks and shoals were encountered, if they still menace, the earnestness of effort and honesty of purpose of the helmsman ring resoundingly true. We know beyond question that the ship of state is now safe, with all on board, and that Franklin Delano Roosevelt is the captain that weathered the storm. The National Democratic Club has the proud privilege and distinction to present our fellow member, the President of the United States.
Mrs. Lehman, President McMahon, Judge Collins, you who celebrate once more the birthday of Thomas Jefferson. It is a very deep pleasure to be welcomed this way, to be welcomed back to my home state of New York. State has loyally supported those progressive policies of government
in the making of which so many of you who are here tonight have taken honorable and successful part. New York State has a long record of almost a generation of liberal government. Each succeeding administration of state affairs building for the future on the best that the past has given us. And I want to take this occasion, this auspicious occasion, to compliment the state on its great good fortune in the loyal, competent, and unselfish service of its present governor, Herbert Lehman. He has continued to extend and strengthen the humane laws for which this state has been noted. History repeats itself. He has met the same type of opposition today which some of us as youngsters, and Bob Wagner was one of them, some of us met in the state legislature 25 years ago. The people of this state and the people of every state meet constant obstacles. For example, there has come the news all the way to Washington that the present assembly of this state flouts the obvious requirement of the Constitution of this state when it declines to appropriate the sum necessary to meet the debt requirements of the state during the coming fiscal year. And this same assembly balks when it comes to providing relief for those in need. But my friends, 25 years ago, and 10 years ago, and 5 years ago, we won. And Herbert Lehman is going to win again. As a New Yorker, I am confident, and I think you are too, that a vast majority of our citizens, this autumn, as in the past, will invite Herbert Lehman to serve for 2 years more as our chief executive. A century ago, this country was regarded as an economic unit. But as time went on, things happened. The country, bit by bit, was cut up into segments. We heard more and more about the problems of particular localities, of particular groups. More and more people put on blinders. They could see only their own individual interests or the single community in which their business happened to be located. And it is only in these comparatively recent days that we have been turning back to the broader vision of the Founding Fathers. The cities of the nation and the countrysides near them have come to realize each other's existence. And the same idea is spreading on a national scale. So that is why, while I may be breaking another precedent, and they say in Washington that my day is not complete without smashing at least one precedent, that is why I can come here to the city of New York and talk with you about the cotton problem of Georgia, the corn and hog problem of Iowa, the wheat problem of the Dakotas, the dust storms of the West, the destructive tornadoes in the South, and the floods in the Northeast. And in the same way, I would not hesitate to discuss the slum clearance problems or any other problems of the big cities of the East with any farmer audience in Georgia or Iowa or the Dakotas or anywhere else, because we're becoming nationally minded. The strong arm of the nation is needed not in immediate relief alone. We all grant that. It is needed also in taking measures of prevention before disasters occur. And it is needed equally in taking measures to prevent economic disasters which are not natural but are made by man. During these past 3 years, I am quite convinced that the Hester Street and Park Avenue of this city have both come to understand that they belong in the same economic pattern and indeed to the same nation as the cotton, corn, and hog belts and the flood areas and dust bowl. Not long ago, it was the farm against the city, and the city against the farm. But from now on, if both are to prosper, it must and shall be the farm with the city, and the city with the farm. Some economists are still trying to find out what it was that hit us back in 1929. I am not a professional economist, but I think I know. What hit us was a decade of debauch, of group selfishness. The sole objective expressed in the thought, every man for himself, as the governor has said, and I'm going to cap it, and the devil take the hindmost. And the trouble was, the result was, that about 98% of the American population turned out to be the hindmost. Let me illustrate what happened by taking the case of the garment worker in the city of New York. They make about 40% of all the clothes of the nation worn outside of New York. That's an amazing statement. Their work and wages in this city were dependent on the sales they made all over the country. Now, the garment workers' depression here did not begin in 1929. It began back in 1921, when the depression began on the farms of the nation. But back in the 20s, people in power still thought of prosperity chiefly in industrial or financial terms. They overlooked the farm depression, and because it went unrelieved, the troubles that started among the farmers in 1921 finally and inevitably reached the garment workers on 8th Avenue. Nebraska's corn and 8th Avenue's clothing are not different problems. They are the same national problem. Before the war, a Nebraska farmer could take a 200-pound hog to market and buy a suit of clothes made in the city of New York. But in 1932, in order to get that same suit of clothes, he had to take 2.5 hogs to market. Back in the 20s, a cotton farmer had to raise 7 pounds of cotton to buy one pair of New York-made overalls. By 1932, however, he had to raise 14 pounds of cotton to get those overalls. Let us get the common sense of it. Obviously, the farmers stopped buying as many clothes. And when the farm districts stopped buying, New York's garment districts started bread lines. That, however, was only half the vicious circle. When the garment districts' bread lines grew longer, buying power in the cities as a whole grew less. Other bread lines formed. Every man on a new bread line meant one person who ate less and wore less. Because the garment worker ate less, the farmer sold less, and his income went down. And so the vicious strangling circle was complete. Today, we have broken that throttle hold, and the American electorate proposes that it shall not be renewed. And while I am talking of food consumption, at the end of this grand dinner, here's a fact of equal interest to the city dweller and the farmer population. If all of the 7 million people living in the city of New York could afford to buy the bread and the meat and the vegetables and the milk and the fish and the cotton and the wool, that their health and a decent living call for, then we in this country would need crop production from 3 million more acres of good crop land than we are using today to feed and clothe the city of New York. And my friends, we propose to continue the fight for more food and better homes. I propose that the man who was forgotten in those olden days shall not be forgotten again. This tie-up between cities and farms is one of the chief reasons why in 1933 we sought a national solution for a national problem. We sought simultaneously to raise the farmer's cash income and to add to the working man's pay envelope. What our success has been, you can prove by the simple process of putting the financial page of any newspaper published in 1936 alongside the financial page of the same newspaper published in 1936. 32. And by financial pages, I do not mean, as some of you might think, merely the stock market quotations, although all will agree that they, too, have at least passed panic prices. By financial pages, I mean the published prices of farm products and raw materials and the many reports of increased industrial earnings. And by the way, speaking of activity, speaking of progress and a greater prosperity, every time that I come back to the city of New York, I keep looking, looking for that grass that was to grow in our city streets. Some individuals are never satisfied. People complain to me about the current costs of rebuilding America, about the burden on future generations. And I tell them that whereas the deficit of the federal government this year is about $3 billion, the national income of the people of the United States has risen from $55 billion in the year 1932 to $65 billion in the year 1936. And I tell them further that the only burden we need to fear is the burden that our children would have to bear if we fail to take these measures today. Building national income, distributing it more widely, means not only the bettering of conditions of life, but the end of and insurance against individual and national deficits in the days to come. Nationwide thinking, nationwide planning, and nationwide action are the three great essentials to prevent nationwide crises for future generations to struggle through. Yes, and other individuals are never satisfied. One of them, for example, that I read about the other day, belongs to a newly organized brain trust, not mine. He says that the only way to get complete recovery, and I wonder if he really admits that we've had any recovery at all, that the only way is to lower prices by cheapening the costs of production. Let us reduce that to plain English. You can cheapen the costs of industrial production by two methods. One is by the development of new machinery and new technique and by increasing employee efficiency. And we do not forbid that. But do not dodge the fact that this means fewer men employed and more men unemployed. And the other way to reduce the costs of industrial production is to establish longer hours for the same pay, or to reduce the pay for the same number of hours. If you lengthen hours, you will need fewer workers
for the same output. More men out of work. If you choose lower wages for the same number of hours, you can cut, and you do cut, the dollars in the pay envelope and automatically cut down the purchasing power of the worker himself. And equally, we are against that. Now, a reduction of costs of manufacture by cutting wages or lengthening hours does not mean more purchasing power and more goods consumed. It means the exact opposite. The history of that period from 1929 to 1933 shows that consumption of goods actually declines with a declining price level. And the reason is obvious. The reason is that in such periods, the buying power of the nation goes down faster than the prices go down. On the other hand, if you increase buying power, prices will go up, but more goods will be bought. Wages ought to and must go up with prices. It does not mean unsound inflation or skyrocketing prices. Those should be avoided just as we seek to avoid deflation and bankruptcy sale value. What we do seek are a greater purchasing power and a reasonably stable and constant price level. And we are attaining that end. It is my belief, and I think it is yours as well, that the industry and agriculture of America subscribe to that objective. Towards that end, representative government of every form is working. The objective cannot be obtained in a month or a year. We know that. But, my friends, results proven by facts and figures show that we are on our way, very definitely on our way. Higher wages for workers, more income for farmers. They mean more goods produced, more and better food eaten, fewer unemployed, and lower taxes. That is my economic and social philosophy. And I might add, incidentally, that it is my political philosophy as well. And finally, I believe from the bottom of my heart that it is the philosophy of the America of 1936.
Tightly packed diners, formally dressed, standing at attention, applauding vociferously, the President of the United States concludes his Jefferson Day dinner address before the National Democratic Club of New York in the Grand Ballroom of the Hotel Commodore in New York City. Dressed in dinner jacket and black tie, the president on the arm of his personal friend, Gus Genrick, is about to leave the hall as Judge Collins rises to make a few concluding remarks.
This night will long live in our memory. Mere words of appreciation, delectation, or description would be weakly superfluous. The festivities of our 102nd annual Jefferson dinner have now reached a glorious conclusion. I'll ask the audience all to remain until the president leaves.
The President of the United States, with Mrs. Roosevelt at his side and such distinguished Democrats as James A. Farley and James J. Dooling, flanking him, is about to leave the grand ballroom of the Hotel Commodore in New York City. The audience, as Judge Collins has already announced, standing at attention until the President of the United States has left. He pauses frequently on his way out, shaking hands with his old friends, the Democratic Party, who are assembled here for this festive dinner on Jefferson's birthday, April the 13th, really being Jefferson's birthday by the new calendar, but it being celebrated on the 25th this year, so that the President of the United States might make this trip from Washington, D.C. to be the guest of honor at the dinner. From here, the President spends the night in New York City in his home, and tomorrow proceeds to his mother's home in Hyde Park, Dutchess County, New York. So ends the President's address, the last scheduled presidential speaking tour, however brief, until the opening of the Texas Centennial on June the 6th. Robert Trout speaking. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.